Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Coming up this weekend, January 18th to the 20th, I'm going to be at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Edmonton, Canada. That's right. I'm going to Canada in January, people. So that's how that works. Hope you guys can come out and see me if you're up there. And if you're not, I think you should fly in to see me. I think it's worth it. My guest this week, my pal Matty Stout. Really cool guy who started in radio when he was 16. He's one of the best and biggest radio producers in the country, and has been in the forefront of podcasting, Stitcher Network, and worked with G. Gordon Liddy and produced him from Watergate fame. Just a really cool guy who you should know about, because if you've been listening to radio in the last 20 years, you've probably been listening to some of his work, and he's now on the forefront of podcasting. So enjoy Matty, and hope you guys can make it out to see me at the Comic Strip Comedy Club, Edmonton Mall, January 18th to the 20th. Enjoy, Matty. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for checking it out. I hope you guys had a good week. I'm on with a good friend of mine, very, very talented guy, groundbreaking guy. Got his start in radio when he was 16 years old. It's my pal, Matty Stout, calling in from the West Coast. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Paul. What's shaking?
I'm good, man. You're a little flustered because you're used to interviewing people, but now you're the guest. You don't have any notes in front of you. I'm going to try to make you cry at least a couple of times during this, so be prepared. I've got stuff about you that's going to really like rock your world.
That's all right. I'll be taking notes on you and sending you the recap afterwards on what I think about your production.
Well, I'm not wearing any pants. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing when you're doing podcasting, but I feel like it loosens me up. Balls out, ready to go.
Yep.
So Matty is digital programming director for iHeartMedia and oversees six San Francisco radio station brands. Very big job, and for a very big company. He's also a professor at Academy of Art University, and he developed the first podcast production program of its kind in the entire United States. Does that include Puerto Rico? That includes Puerto Rico, correct?
I think it does include Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands.
And then there's Matty Media, which is a front for stolen goods, mainly stereos, cassette decks, and 8-track players.
They're
coming back, and Matty's got the market cornered. It's a branded content podcast company, and it's really on the cutting edge. And Matty is very, very cool. We got to know each other years ago when I came to Alice Radio when I was at the Punchline, and you were the producer of the morning show there, right?
We actually met in New York after an Opie and Anthony show. And
oh, we did. I forget about that.
Yeah, that's where I met. We went out, I don't know, one or two times probably, and had drinks. But, you know, when I got to San Francisco, you know, the first criticism everybody gave me was, why do you keep booking these New York comedians? And I'm like, because they're gold and they know how to talk and they know how to hang out and do a show and not just come on and do shtick. And when you were coming through town, you were one of the guys I was like, oh, absolutely. We got to get Paul in. And then you end up coming in pretty much every time that you were around.
Yeah. And it was like an instant thing, you know, when you kind of, you go on some of these shows and it's just an instant connection. And it was, and it's not easy to do because, you know, as a producer, you're managing, you know, three or four on-air people, the hosts and co-hosts. And then you've got this X factor that comes in, and there's a lot to juggle there. It's tricky. And, I mean, you've had a lot of experience. I mean, you started when you were 16, in West Virginia, in your hometown. And did you know then that you sort of had this bug for this, or was it just like, at that point, just a little hobby, or did you think this was going to be a long-term thing?
I don't think at the time I realized that, but looking back, I was the kid who recorded all the radio breaks and would call the radio station the minute I could dial a phone, and did, you know, I found a tape of myself at age 10 doing a little radio show where I was doing voices and all of that. Cause I'd listen. My mom raised just my brother and I, and she didn't have, let's just say we had a lot of freedom because she wasn't around a lot because she was working. So I would listen to Howard Stern on DC 101. And I don't remember. Wow. And I just remember when he did the bit about calling the Air Florida after they crashed in the 14th Street Bridge and said, how much is it for a one-way ticket to the 14th Street Bridge? I'm like 8 or 9, but I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That got him kicked off that station and he booted out of town.
Yes,
right?
It did.
What was it about? I had Bob Costas on the show, and he talks about when he was 10 or 11 and he would lie in bed at night in St. Louis as a kid and have a transistor radio at the time. For those of you who don't know what a transistor radio is, look it up, assholes. he would listen to the St. Louis Cardinals game, but he was more enthralled with, while he loved the game, he was more enthralled with the broadcaster and the picture that they were able to paint. And that sort of drew him to the idea of being a broadcaster. What was it about the radio that, and you calling in and on those breaks, was there something magical for you, you think?
Well, I think that I've always been drawn to talking. Yeah. And I like,
trust me, as your friend, I can attest to that.
I think talking's wonderful.
When you take him out, it's a great guy, but you have to take a ball gag with you, you know, because at some point you got to just have Maddie just, you know, back it down a little bit. You know?
Oh, yeah. And especially back in my my Coke and booze days. Boy, I thought I was hilarious. But, you know, I think for me, one of the biggest turns came when I was my mom got remarried when I was about around 11 years old. We moved to this mountain in West Virginia, and we literally had no plumbing or no running water, no electricity for the first 6 months. And mm-hmm. then after that, we had electricity, but we didn't have any television. So I could listen to NBC TV on my radio, and I had no neighbors. You know, I was.
Wait, you could listen to TV on the radio?
Yeah. I don't know how that worked. So I would listen to People's Court, and then I would listen to Santa Barbara, which put me in wonderful condition for when I did meet Robin Wright Penn. I knew all the Kelly Capwell facts, and it really impressed her. But, you know, I got that. That's where I started to, you know, really imagine, you know, what I was hearing on the radio.
Right. Did you feel like this would just be a hobby? I mean, because you, but it sounds like you really sort of, it ramped up as you went along and, or did it sort of sit for you as just something that you were going to do as a hobby?
Well, I mean, in high school, I got into it because I knew I liked radio, and there was a local station, and they had an AM station that, that ran high school sports, and they had a job offer for me to like do that from time to time where I just put commercials in. But my main job there, which was the money job, was Sunday mornings at 6 a.m. I would play The Sounds of Sinatra, and it came on an album, and I'd put the needle down.
As a kid, you were playing Sinatra?
Yeah. And I got to do the weather every half hour. And you know, I remember the first day I was on the air, I put the needle down, it scratched, I left the mic on, I yelled shit 3 times.
Live on the air?
Live on the air, and the owner comes in, and I always tell this to my students, the owner came in, and he put the needle back on, calm as can be, turned the mic off, and he looked at me, and he goes, are you ever going to do that again? I said, nope. He goes, okay, and walked out. Didn't yell at me, didn't do anything, but just, you know, that whole idea of like, hey, you're going to make some mistakes. But,
is that what the message you took from that was, that it's okay to make mistakes, but just don't keep making them?
Yeah, exactly. Cause yeah, I mean, that's the only way you learn, you know, you know, failure is the best teacher. And, I think for me, the first time that I had somebody actually wake up at 6 a.m., which took a while before anybody actually, I was begging everybody and heard me do the weather and told me they heard me on the radio. I was smitten then. Like I wanted that. I needed that reassurance. I need that constant, hey, I heard you on the radio thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There is something, and you forget like as a guest, anyway, you're in this little room and you're talking into this piece of metal and you forget that it affects a lot of people and it impacts a lot of people and a lot of people hear it. Cause then you go out and people are on the street or somebody says, I heard you this morning. And I think that there's something really cool about that. There's a sense of, maybe power, but also, the room's so small, you can really feel intimate and forget that you're talking to a bunch of people and, you know, as opposed to just talking to your friend in a room somewhere, you know?
And it's, you know, I'll say this, I didn't realize how addicted to it I was.
Yeah.
When I left my morning show 10 years ago, I got into, I started drinking a ton when I was, because I didn't realize it at the time, but a lot of it was, I was depressed. I didn't have an audience. I didn't have that endorphin that anymore. And yeah. after getting sober, I realized, that a lot of that, it's medical, it's genetic, and I have I'm an endorphin junkie. So when I wasn't getting that on the radio, I was trying to find it somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, the one part which I didn't know was that you moved to DC. You were 24. You became one of the youngest executive producers in the country. But and at this point, you took over the show, the syndicated G. Gordon Liddy show, which is out of Washington, was national. And G. Gordon Liddy, for those who don't know, was involved with the Watergate scandal and just. A pretty badass guy. What was that like? What was he like? How at 24? I can't imagine trying to, because executive producer, you got to kind of manage the talent. How you manage a guy like that, who held his supposedly hand over a flame to prove how tough he was? I mean, how did that come about? What was that like?
Dumb luck. Well, first of all, how it came about was, I had always been like very aggressive with my career and trying to make it to the next step. And at the time, I was a country music DJ in West Virginia, and I was sending air checks out, which is, kind of a demo tape, to every station. And I almost got hired in Charleston, South Carolina, and I almost got hired in Columbus, Ohio. And I thought, man, if I could just make it to a big market like Columbus, I'll really be making it. And I sent an intern to DC and said, hey, go to WJFK. That's my favorite station. It's talk. It's great. Donna Mike, you're going to love it. Mm-hmm. And while she was there her first week, the assistant producer for Gordon had quit. And she said, hey, you're always talking about wanting to move up. Why don't you try this job out? Had no experience, didn't know what it was to produce a show, but I was used to working with talent older than me who didn't respect me until they found out I actually knew what I was talking about. And I drove to DC and talked my way into this job. I took a pay cut from West Virginia to be the assistant producer.
You took a pay cut from West Virginia. How was that even possible?
I went from $23,000 a year to $20,000 a year.
Back up. So you met with the general manager of the station?
I met with the executive producer of the show, which John Pop. And, he saw my passion for radio and the fact that, I was always the guy asking questions, and I learned what everybody did at the station. I knew what the engineers did. I knew what the sales staff did. I knew what promotions do. I was a radio nerd, and he liked that. And the very first week I'm there, I just moved to DC. I moved in with these three crazy people because it was the only house I could find. And the first day they tell me I have to fly to San Diego and produce Gordon because the executive producer had to leave for the week. Mm-hmm. So my very first day on the job, I'm across the board from Gordon Liddy. And to be honest with you, I didn't know any better than to just do what I knew the job was, which was tell him when to take breaks, tell him, what to do this and when to do these things.
And so you kind of didn't but you knew of him or you didn't. And then, so you weren't as intimidated as you would be if you knew who he was.
Yeah. Or even understood the job. I mean, I didn't really understand talk radio. I didn't understand everything. So everything that I learned, I just did it the way I was taught. And after a couple weeks, I found out the EP pulled me aside. He took me to dinner. He told me everything he knows about Gordon Liddy, which I know some things that I'm still not allowed to say until he dies.
And just to be specific for people, he was sort of the chief operative in charge of, in the White House plumbers unit that went around and did sort of this, nefarious, illegal sort of digging into people's lives, wiretapping, burglary. And
he's the only one that went to jail.
Yeah, exactly. And he was the one that organized and directed the burglary of the Democratic National Convention in the Watergate building that started everything and led to the demise and resignation of Nixon. So this guy is and a former Harvard professor, too. Just an amazing guy. So you know some things that you can't even say, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. They are. Okay. And so what was what were some of the things that he told you at the time that you could tell us that kind of stood out for you?
Well, I mean, a couple of my favorite Gordon stories were that very first week I was there, we were on the air And we have these things called hard breaks where you can't take a break until it's a specific time when you're syndicated. We had 400 stations. And he's in the middle of an interview and he looks over and he goes, "Young Matt, I've gotta go to the bathroom. Can we take a break?"
He talks just like that. That's an awesome
And he always
impression.
Called me Young Matt Stout. And he was like, "Young Matt Stout, I need to take a break. Can I do it?" I'm like, "I'm sorry, Gordon, we can't take a break right now." He's like, "All right, well, you and the guests just have a chat." And he walks over and pees in a plant.
He peed and then
he had done that again in front of Chris Matthews when we were interviewing him. That was what he would do when he had to go and he couldn't take a break. But the other thing that I thought was funny and I got to know about Gordon was, and about all type A's, was I found out that when you're the one person who tells them they're not doing things right or that you're not happy, they respect the shit out of you. So in a short time, he really respected me because I wouldn't laugh at something or, you know, I wouldn't respond to things when I didn't think they were good content.
But at that age to be able to someone so intimidating like that? I mean, you know, this is like a military guy, basically. Where'd you get the balls to do that?
Oh, I saw the other side of him, though. I knew that I played ABBA as the music going into a talk, you know, out of commercials in a break. That always made him happy. So like, you know, I knew like
you
that.
Liked ABBA?
He loved G-Gord. ABBA. G-Gordon Liddy loves ABBA. And and the other thing was, you know, I saw like how needy he was as far as wanting, you know, needing to be told he was doing well. We interviewed Sonny Barger, who was the first, you know, guy who started the Hell's Angels. Very intimidating guy. Very, you know, he when you call him to get him for an interview, you have to go through like security. I mean, this guy is badass. And right. We got done the interview and Gordon looks over at me and he goes, "Do you think he liked me?"
Oh,
And that was such a telling thing for me. It was like, okay, he this is somebody he respects and he wants them to like him.
Yeah.
And then I one other quick story. I love this story. It was, we were interviewing Gordon Cooper, the astronaut. Mm. And if you don't know, Gordon Cooper is insane. He believes in, you know, maybe he's not insane, but he believes in extraterrestrials. And we were in the middle of an interview and he starts to tell a story about how he sells his neighbors were aliens and he helped them sell the platinum from their spaceship so that they could settle.
He's insane. You can say.
Yeah. So he's doing this. And so Liddy just looks up at me with his eyes real big. Cause I know Gordon does not want to disrespect an astronaut. Right. And I just looked at him and I did the roll my finger, you know, which is like, keep going. Just keep going with the interview and keep going. And Gordon did, he did a great job. It ended up being one of my favorite interviews that we ever did. And I guess, you know, that was another one of those moments where, you know, he's looking at me for guidance. So that put me in a really good spot.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is a guy he was in a courtroom. He practiced law for 4 years in New York City and he fired a gun in his courtroom, was reprimanded for that. Like he just, he's lived a life that, you know, tenfold. Did you keep in touch with him at all, like later on and, you know, after Watergate and all this other stuff?
I didn't. So I left Gordon. I was only there for close to a year before CBS offered me the job to take over mornings at WNEW in New York. And Gordon was very supportive and really was happy that I'd gotten the job because I wasn't I've ended up doing more political talk than I actually would like, but it's something I'm fairly good at as far as picking content. And so he was supportive. He knew I wanted to do other things. And I ended the time, I was scared to death. I just left West Virginia and now
what
I'm moving
year,
to New York
what
City.
Year was this?
98.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you only stayed 1 year. But I'm sure you learned a lot. And what did you take away from, because I think the good thing with that is you learn how to produce that kind of person. And then you have to learn how to produce personalities, right? And different people need different things from their executive producer.
Yeah.
What did you take away? Because he's a very unique person, but a type A, which I think there are a lot of type A's in entertainment, particularly and in radio. What did you take away? What was your big learning moments from him, producing him?
I think that a lot of it was, you know, like I said, being the person who tells the type A that, that things aren't good. You know, when they want, you know, where everybody else is saying, "Oh, that was great. That was great." And you're the one that goes, "That wasn't that good. That break wasn't good. I hope, are you happy with that break? 'Cause I'm not happy with that break." And I think that in general, you know, the job of executive producer has gone away a lot in radio because of the fact that most talent don't want that. They don't want to have somebody to question them. They want to have be the ultimate authority in what's right. And it's sad because I think radio suffers when you don't have a strong EP.
Right.
You know, my mentor, Jeremy Coleman, you know, his attitude was, when you're the executive producer of the show, I don't yell at the talent. I yell at you, because it's your job to make sure they're doing the elements as they're supposed to be done.
Right.
And the other thing is to learn how to be a friend and at the same time, give advice without seeming like you're giving advice. You know, make it seem
almost
like,
make it feel like, it's his idea, sort of, or her idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that was a big learning experience, and just working at WJFK with all the personalities there. And, you know, that world of FM talk radio, and especially WNEW New York, was just crazy. I mean, you talk about a bunch of type A's, you got four shows on the air. They're all talk shows and they all think they're the most important show on radio.
Right.
So,
and you're producing the morning show at the time.
So I was producing the morning show, the sports guys. It was at the time, Sid Rosenberg, who was still on, in New York. And then this other guy that ended up, we fired, and then I helped hire the new co-host. And the guy that I helped hire was Craig Carton, who's now famous.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And I found out very soon after he got there what a jackass he was. He was just not a nice guy.
He had to be young at the time, right? Was he in his 20s?
Yeah, he was a little older than me, I think. Maybe I was 25 or 6, and he was like maybe close to 30. And was he just
arrogant, or?
He liked for other people, he liked to seem like he was a nice guy, but then behind closed doors would be like a real asshole and make you be his asshole. And I didn't like that. I didn't. You know, and at the time, I'll be honest with you, I probably wasn't the right producer for that show either. It wasn't a great fit all around. But
why would you say that? What was wrong? What was wrong there?
Well, it was a sports talk show, and I didn't know that much about sports. You know, I knew how to run a show, but you know, I wasn't familiar with the content. Right. And that, you can't do that. And I think that was, you know, he had that, you know, we had that issue, which was, you know, fine. But you know, in general, he was so awful to the people on my staff that I hated it. And, you know, and the thing that he did that always has left a bad taste in my mouth is when he tried to get me fired, they said, okay, well, we're not going to fire him, but we'll move him over to help out with Opie and Anthony, which was great because that's what I wanted to do. And and then, you know, that you guys will not have an executive producer anymore. He called me that night and said, if I hear that you say anything about me or tell anybody bad about me, I will destroy you on the air. I will get you. Mm. Called me, said that to me.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you listen to his show, that's what he does.
Didn't part of you want to just talk shit about him as a big fuck you, or you were just like, you just said, I'm not going to bother, and just leave it alone and kept quiet?
No, he wasn't worth my time. I knew he wasn't going to be there much longer, and he wasn't. He was fired a couple months after that.
Did they fire him because of ratings or just a bad attitude or what?
I think all of the above. I mean, our ratings were abysmal. I think we were like 34th in the market. But we were, you know, we were opposite Howard, and we were on a CBS station, so we weren't supposed to compete with Howard.
Right. And is there a difference for you in producing news versus FM, where you have, you know, you have songs, music to play up, presumably, or are the principles the same in producing regardless of what the format and or, you know, content of the show is?
I think that the principle is the same, and it's you know, beginning and ending with content. I would say that one of the biggest difference, you know, between radio now and doing FM talk then was we had a lot more room to breathe. Where the way ratings are done with radio now, with this thing called People Meter, they don't let shows breathe anymore. So
listening, People Meter means you literally walk around. It used to be that people would write in a book. A select number of people would write in a book about what their listening habits were, and then that would be given to a ratings company. Now there are meters that people wear, and it just detects what's being played as you go through your day, right?
Yeah. And it's done every 15 minutes. So it's just the way it's done, it doesn't support the kind of radio that I like to do, which was, you know, like I was saying, you know, when I have a comedian in, it was come in and hang out and do the show. Come to my world. You know, I always tell this to hosts. I'm like, when you have a guest on, remember, they're coming to your world. And when you stop your world and do a different world for the guest, the listeners aren't into it. You know, you have to be able to bring them in.
And it doesn't fit. You know, I was just in a market that I hadn't been in, and I always call the shows ahead of time and ask the producer how they like to do their show. Cause I'm happy to just sit and hang and, you know, shoot the shit, or some places want you to give them setups and lead you into material. And yes, I'd rather you know what I mean? Like then stepping on each other's toes, and I'm a guest in their house. And if it goes well, everybody wins. You know, I mean, the listeners have a good time and they come out to see me and the show goes well. And I can't tell you how many times, and I'm not patting myself on the back, it's just like they go, boy, people never do this. They just come in. And I'm like, that just seems so odd to me. You know what I mean? It seems so, it's so counterintuitive. I don't know.
Well, you care about your craft. And I'm going to say that I think that in general with comedians that I was around, you know, coming up in radio in New York, they were better communicators, where I feel like the younger comedians, if it's not on social media, they don't really communicate and more or less call somebody and talk to them. You know, that's crazy. Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, the art of conversation is becoming definitely a lost art, at least, you know, off of radio anyway. But the thing that's really cool about you is you went to San Francisco and you produced there for 8 years and the Alice Morning Show, which is, you know, a big, very big show in San Francisco. Again, sort of taking all these, do you prefer FM versus to news, and what did you learn? How did that help you grow 8 years at the Alice Morning Show?
Well, it was, you know, the good thing was we got to do talk on a music station, and that was fun. But the best part of that was really working with talent who we were partners. You know, Sarah, who's the host at the time, her co-host Vinny, who is now her co-host again, had some issues and had been let go. And I talked her through that whole breakup process while I drove cross country. I did the search for a new host. I mean, it was a team thing, and we were a really good team, you know. And on that team, I learned how to, you know, read, you know, when you can read the room and read what the other person's thinking. And we did a lot of improv stuff before, you know, looking back on it, you know, I look at it like, wow, we did a lot of improv. But at the time, you didn't think about it being improv. It was just, hey, this is how we're doing the show right now.
Right.
So it really helped me spread my wings. And, everything good that's in my life right now probably started with that show. As far as, you know, I met my wife. She was a listener. She sent me an email one day about something I'd said on the air. And
that's called stalking, but good for you.
Yeah,
good.
No,
you married a stalker.
I did not marry a stalker. She just was interested in that one particular thing. But you know, and I'm still very close with them, and leaving that show was a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be at the time. At the time, I didn't realize how much of my life had been devoted to the show, which was another reason I left, because when you're on a show like that and it is your life and you call your wife your host's name at home constantly and your mood is dependent upon her mood. And Sarah was the host and my wife is Shauna, and I called her Sarah all the time. And Sarah and I's moods would get so tied into each other that everyone around the building would know if one of us was in a bad mood. Because the other one would be in a bad mood.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, the problem comes in if you start yelling the name out during sex. then you really got a problem.
No, like, I'm a silent whimperer during sex, so it's okay. I tend to...
You and me both. You're stealing my act, man. You and me both. So did you feel like... I mean, you've been on the air and behind the scenes as a producer. Was it anywhere in your mindset, I want to go full bore, one or the other, full bore on the air and really give that a go? Or how did that play out for you?
You know, I did. When I first left Alice, when I was first thinking about leaving Alice and leaving that morning show, it was to go do my own show with a partner, Marcus Osborne, who I went on and did Straight Male Friend with, which was
an yeah. And I went on that show and I met Marcus, and Marcus is now managing at the Punchline and really great guy. And you guys had a great show, and I thought you were really good together.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, reasons why we broke up as a team. And a lot of it had to do with me at the time with, you know, I'd moved to LA. After I left, I'm kind of jumping ahead in the storyline, but I left Stitcher after about 3 years and went to LA to work for Kevin Smith. And it was a fucking disaster. It just was a disaster on all ends.
For his radio? What were you doing for him?
So he wanted to take Smodcast and make it into a morning show. And it went from being, hey, let's do this live morning show with a co-host in this studio and all this stuff, to let's do it in my house and my wife is the co-host. And I'm not putting any of the blame. I'm not blaming Kevin at all, because I was also a mess at the time. You know, I was having some serious issues with drinking and, you know, but that got worse after that show, because that show, I'd never been let go. I had never had a project that didn't work out, and I was a fucking mess at the end of it. And that led into, you know, like it was hard for me to work with Marcus after that. Cause I did my own shit to take care of.
It's good you knew that. So go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so I wanted to go do my own morning show. I mean, I think that, you know, that's always been, you know, anybody who's on the air, you want to go do your own show. But then this opportunity came up to go and be a part of this new company, Stitcher. And that, you know, as somebody who'd only done radio his whole life, a chance to be at a startup and learn business and all this other stuff, it was a great opportunity. So I went and did that instead.
Yeah, that's a podcast radio app. And that was like kind of groundbreaking, because you're essentially going up against Apple. And what was the thinking behind that? It was just the feeling that in the marketplace you needed another alternative, or what drove that?
Well, we were we were the first podcast app, and we came out when the first iPhone came out. So when I got to Stitcher, there were just four of us. Mm-hmm. And we were, to be honest with you, ahead of the time. You know, we got into mobile early. We didn't, and it's still going strong now. And it's great to hear that, you know, when people talk about podcasting apps, Stitcher is always the first one they talk about after Apple. So that's always, you know, it's really thrilling that, you know, to be a part of that. But at the time, I just knew that it was talk radio. I didn't really understand what podcast was. I still, you know, I was kind of like, I get it. It's just pre-recorded talk radio. Okay, I got it.
And
it was, you know, working in content. And at the same time, the guys that ran it were, you know, Harvard grads, MIT grads, Wharton, you know, these, you know, all these educations. And then me, this kid from West Virginia with absolutely no business experience and no startup experience.
But you had valuable radio experience, and they didn't, obviously.
They didn't understand content. They didn't understand, you know, why you need to place content in certain categories and what podcasts would be the ones we should promote. And
How did you guys find each other? How did this come about?
You know, Hooman from the morning show?
Yeah. From the Sarah and Vinny show.
Yeah,
we were just talking about. Yep.
He's a social climber.
You go out with him and he's constantly like, he knows somebody, he's like the mayor of San Francisco, or he's constantly like Snapchatting and posting stuff on Instagram, like literally every 14 steps. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And that's it. You know, he'd introduced me to somebody from the company, and, I didn't understand what the company was, and I was like, okay, thanks. And then the guy, Noah Shanuk, who was the CEO and founder, he called me and said, hey, you know, can you come in for a meeting? And I was so tired, I almost didn't go to the meeting. But after my meeting with him, I was so inspired and saw the potential there that I left. You know, it's like, all right, this is what I'm going to go do. All right. And everybody thought I was absolutely insane for leaving a popular radio show, to go do this. Cause I wasn't fired. In fact, I did a whole month of goodbyes on the air, which you never get to do in radio.
When did you start to really feel like podcasting was going to take hold and then blow up to this extent? You know, because there was a time when I would go through the country doing my stand up, and you go on the local morning shows and they wouldn't let me they wouldn't let me promote my podcast on the radio shows because they viewed it as competition and eroding the ratings and taking viewership away, listenership away. So now I'm obviously a lot of these big radio conglomerates have jumped on the bandwagon, which is a good thing. But when did you know or have a gut that this is not a passing fad?
I think that when I really knew, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think it would ever, I didn't know if it would ever get as big as it's gotten. Mm-hmm. But when Serial came out, and I'd already been in this business for a little while, probably 6 years at the time. When Serial came out, I was, I teach at university, and it was the first time that there was a podcast where people would come in the room and hear you talking about it and go, no, I didn't listen to this week. Don't. And they'd walk out. I never had that kind of experience with a podcast before, where there was just this universal, like, water cooler talk about a podcast.
And it's almost like your favorite TV show, and you don't want to know, you didn't get a chance to see it yet.
Exactly. Kind of, and I never seen that with podcasts. And I hadn't seen that with that generation either. And that's when it really, to me, I saw, okay, this isn't just for, folks that like talk radio. This is for a lot of people. And the last 2 years have just been amazing for this industry, and watching how it's grown and seeing companies like iHeart, really embrace it and try to move forward in that space.
Do you think there are too many? You think it shakes out in some, it seems like there's so many now. How do you stand out with a podcast from, there have to be more podcasts and radio shows. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know the numbers, but I could be wrong about that, but it just seems like there's a ton now.
Yeah. There's, in the hundreds of thousands, I think at this point. But I think that good content always stands out.
Yeah.
I think that when you look at the charts and what's doing well, it does come from the same kind of five camps, basically, or, less than that, mostly NPR type programming, which is very well produced and has a lot of work done on it. Or it's already got a celebrity lead, which brings its own audience to start with. But, I tell people all the time, if you're going to make it in this business, you better have a unique selling point. It means other people can be doing it, but you need to do it in a way that nobody else is and do it better. And right. It's got to be produced well. And because people will come back to well-produced content. They won't tolerate listening to a show after, if they listen to 5 minutes of it and it's terribly produced, they're not going to go back to that or even finish it. There's too much other stuff to listen to.
Right. So what you've been able to take all the radio experience and put it into podcasting, obviously, and producing podcasts, but now at iHeart, you're a program director. Explain to people kind of what that means in the world of podcasting and digital media and for a company that big.
Well, it is a new job. I didn't know I wanted to do this job until another company offered it to me last year. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that they had very sound strategy as far as their digital. And I saw the potential for iHeart as far as a player that had, 300 million people that have already downloaded it. And, a program
director downloaded the app.
The app. Yeah. So, traditionally a program director runs the radio station. Everything you hear on the air is what the program director is. So a digital program director, I'm in charge of everything you don't hear on the air. So that goes from everything from social media to websites to videos and, of course, podcasting. And I work with my talent just like a program director would. I sit and air check them, and I'm lucky. I have I'm kind of rare in the field as far as I have so much experience on air and working with talent that it's very natural for me. And trying to teach radio people how to do a podcast, which it's not, they're not the same thing.
How are they different?
Well, on a radio, especially now with, people meter, the breaks are short and you're talking at somebody, it's like, Hey you, where in a podcast, you're creating empathy and you're talking.
Are you really talking at people? Because if you have a morning show that's very conversational, it's the principle of those shows to me as a listener and as a person who goes on them is the listener is a fly on the wall listening to conversations among these three or four people.
No, you're right. And I guess I'm excluding morning shows in this, because with morning shows, they should already know how to do this. A lot of them, mm-hmm. they don't want to do an extra show every day. And right. those that have done it are doing quite well at it. Bobby Bones is a good example. He's a country DJ who's hugely popular, and his podcast is super popular, but it, you know, he's worked on, you know, just doing this podcast as well on the side, but mm. you know, more for the jocks that are on the other day parts where they got in the business to be entertaining and to do things. And yeah. that's not what the business asks of them anymore. So with a podcast, it's everything that they think they want to do, but it's also relearning how to talk slower, how to build out content, how to take the off ramps from the highway of information. Cause you know, in radio, they stay on the highway. Don't take any off ramps and just go from A to B, where, you know, with a podcast, I want you to go A, well, B, C, D, E, F.
Explain to listeners, what does that mean? Get a little more, stay on the highway. Don't take off ramps. In other words, explain that a little bit.
If we're doing a break about cabbages, mm-hmm. we're going to talk about cabbages, and that's it. Cabbages, cabbages, cabbages. And it's going for a very short time, and I'm going to go from A to B. I know where I want to start about cabbages and where I want to end about cabbages. Mm. Where on a podcast, we might start going about cabbages, but then, oh my gosh, my mom and dad used to make me make sauerkraut, and I'm going to talk about sauerkraut for a little bit. And then,
yeah, that's what I love about it. Yeah. I had Thomas Friedman, the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, can't sound any drier than that. And halfway into it, he's telling me a story about how he learned his first dirty joke from Chichi Rodriguez, the professional golfer, when he was caddying at 17. And that is why I love doing my podcast, because I feel like I want people to get a window into people they think they know, but they don't know everything about them, to round out the person or to expose them to people that they don't know who they should know.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, I think that's the, for me, one of the primary beauties of a podcast is, you know, I'll do my prep and I'll have the things I want to ask. But in almost every conversation, we end up going off somewhere that I didn't plan. And that's what I love about it.
And I think that's the difference between, you know, I'm lucky I came out of that Stern school of radio and where mm-hmm. your life's on the air. And mm-hmm. you know, the more personal, I mean, this conversation was going to be about career and all this stuff, but I end up, you know, mentioning my battle with alcoholism and right. how that affected my career, because that's a part of my story. And if mm-hmm. I don't tell you that, I'm not being honest. And when I'm not being right. honest, I'm not doing good radio as far as I'm concerned.
I wanted to ask you, I was going to get back to this, but since you brought it up, so what was there sort of a defining moment that sort of snapped you into like, I got to get some help with this drinking, or was it just an amalgamation of things?
No, it was my mom died. And I was at home visiting, and my mom was my best friend, raised me. I, you know, she was one of those people, she would had no problem telling you who the favorite kid was. You know, it was me. And, you know, she was so funny. She took me to my first concert, which was George Carlin.
My
mom was so cool. I was home and she fell down some stairs and died. And we had to take her off life support. And I did not handle it well. I, you know, at one point I was just drinking every day for like 2 weeks, and my wife walked into the room and said, you know, what are you going to do? Are you just going to keep drinking? And I looked at her and I was like, I think I am. And I called a friend of mine who worked in radio, comedian, Greg Baldwin. And he had gotten sober and said, I called him. I said, dude, I don't know what's going on. I got to do something. And he's like, he told my wife, keep him drunk, get him on a plane. And she did, and got me on a plane. And
why keep them drunk? I don't know.
Because when people sober up, they tend to think that, oh, maybe it wasn't that bad. But when they're still in it and they're all, you know, weepy and sad, and that's, I guess that's the deal. And, the counselor, you know, when I finally like started to, you know, figure out where I was and all this stuff, I look up and it's a comedian. I don't think he'll mind me saying this, Ant. The comedian Ant, mm-hmm. I'd had him on the show a lot, and I was just like, oh my God, what's going on here?
He was in the AA program with you?
No, he was my counselor. He was my intake guy. He was the one bringing me in because I went to rehab in LA. And
But he was a recovering alcoholic himself?
Yeah. Wow. Recovering everything. And we always say, my name is Maddie and I'm D, all of the above. but for me, you know, and I'm the kind of person that, when I decide I'm going to do something, I get geeky into it. So I've been geeky into sobriety ever since. And I think it's probably, it is the most wonderful thing to ever happen to me. You know, when you hear people say I'm a grateful alcoholic, it's like, really? Yeah, but no, really I am. If I hadn't gotten to do the program and do all the things that I get to do working with other alcoholics and things like that, I wouldn't be where I'm at in my career or anything right now. So,
did you think, we had a close friend that drank himself to death. And, you know, what we think would happen was, this is a guy who came from a blue collar family in Massachusetts, went to Harvard, went to Columbia Law School, huge overachiever, never saw a setback, and then had two kids, married. And then one day his wife comes home and says, I want a divorce. Didn't see it coming. She wasn't cheating. She just couldn't live with him anymore. He was devastated, moved to a nearby apartment and started drinking because he couldn't go to sleep at night. And never, you know, he tried recovery, but didn't work. So there were other things going on. You know, divorce triggered things. Do you think your mom's death, was it really about your mom's death, or was that a trigger? And were there other things that you were dealing with that you hadn't dealt with before?
No. And here's why I went to rehab. Somebody had said to me, well, he's drinking because his mom died. And I thought, you know what? That's bullshit. I'm drinking because I'm an alcoholic. I had already put my finger on the fact that I was a binge drinker. I had a drinking problem. And at that point I realized I'm just using my mom's death as another reason to just sit and be sorry for myself and be a drunk.
So you were drinking a lot leading up to that, borderline, not, I mean, obviously socially, but more so than most would socially before that is what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I very famously, you know, as part of my shtick on the radio is I was the guy, you know, the bar guy and all this stuff. And I knew better, you know, I knew that I had alcoholism in the family. Mm. My aunt had drank herself to death. Everyone on my dad's side has alcohol problems. So, you know, I knew better. And for me, that was the big realization was like, this is it, man. You know, this is, well, look what you're doing with your mom's memory. You're making it into this drunk thing. And that was it for me. And, you know, and I always tell people, you know, there isn't like one, you know, I'm a firm believer that either you have that gene or you don't. And when you have that gene, there is nothing you can do about it. You can, you can maintain it and you can be what you call a functional alcoholic, which is you're not as functional as you think you are.
But you have to be vigilant over it. You know?
Yeah. Right? And that was for me, like when I did mornings, I got up every morning at 4:30 or 4 in the morning. So I had this way to keep from getting too bad. And, you know, this job that would, you know, also let me on the weekends go really nuts with my drinking. But at the same time, it just gets worse as you get older too. And I think that's one thing that, you know, a lot of people will see that in friends of theirs. It's like, wow, you know, he's drinking a lot more than he used to. And that's usually kind of a sign. Well, you know, it's probably got the gene.
Yeah, well, it's great that you kind of figured that out and you were so honest with yourself. You know, we could never get through to this guy. You know, we all tried talking to him and it was just, you know.
You can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
And he probably had the gene too. I don't think he had alcoholism in his family, but we visit him in rehab. He's like, yeah, I don't need the beers. These other people that need the beer, that kind of stuff, you know? And it's like,
I was in rehab with a bunch of 20-year-old heroin addicts. I was not humble at all at first. And then, you know, in rehab, they take your money. You drive in a little white bus. You have to go to movies together. They give you $5 to buy things at the movies. And here I am. I got a job, a wife and career and, you know, famous radio guy. The thing is, you know, you can't tell an alcoholic anything. They have to know for themselves because they're just going to tell you what you want to hear. My wife had to learn that, you know, with the drinking, that there was nothing, it wasn't her fault. And then, you know, we both had to understand it wasn't my fault either, you know, that
you just screwed with a shitty gene.
Nobody wants to drink themselves to death. Nobody wants to drink to the point where everybody around them thinks they're an asshole. It's the only disease that tells you don't have one.
That's a good way. I never heard it put that way.
It is. Yeah.
It's amazing. How did you get the job? How'd you get the gig as a voiceover gig in Cars? You played Maddie the reporter. How did that come about?
John Lasseter, who I love and adore, and I'm looking forward to him coming back from his hiatus that he's on right now. John listened to my morning show every day. He listened to the Alice Morning Show, and he called us and said, hey, I'm doing this new thing. Would you guys want to come in and try to do some voices? And of course, we're like, yeah. So we went to Pixar, and when you go to Pixar and John Lasseter's directing you, it's you're in a room and he's very, he moves his arms a lot. And he, you know, you're saying these, you know, like, yeah, I think it was like 50 lines I had to say, and you just kept doing them. And then you go home and wait because you have no idea if they're going to make it into the movie. You don't know what parts
so
are going to make it
in an audition. He said, I want you to do this role. You kind of had the role. It was just doing the takes.
Yeah. And it was like, okay, you're going to be one of these cars that are doing this reporting thing. And it just so happened that my car had a couple standout lines and standalone lines. And I didn't, you know, so that was great. It was in the movie. And then, but the most surreal moment was a year later at Christmas when my neighbor kid walks over and he's like, hey, sign this. And I look and it's a toy car with Maddie on it. And I'm like, oh my God,
that's awesome.
I'm a toy. I made it.
You're like an action figure. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I go on eBay and buy them out all the time. I buy them out, give them out to people.
I got to do that. I got to figure out a way to, maybe I'll just create my own action figure of me with my big lips and start trying to hawk it on eBay. Did you like working for the bigger names? I know you had a disaster with Kevin Smith, but you worked with Jamie Foxx. Was that a good experience?
You know, it was a very short experience. I went in, SiriusXM wanted me to come in as a consultant and with some eyes to help
for him. His whole channel.
Yeah, for his channel. And it was one of those deals where although Sirius wanted me there, the folks there did not want me there. And that tends to not work
out. You mean the Jamie Foxx people?
Yeah. And Jamie.
Yeah, again, I don't get that. They don't know anything about radio. Why wouldn't you want to bring in an expert? Why wouldn't you want to compliment your team with somebody like you're like a legend in the business. You've done every part of radio and now podcasting. There's very few people like you on the planet. Like, why would you not embrace that?
Well, I don't like to put the blame on other folks.
Nobody treats Maddie that way. Maddie, the reporter for cars. You know who you're dealing with?
Yeah. And I I'm not blaming this at all, but I was the only Caucasian on the floor. So.
Reverse racism.
Serious. Not saying that. Just saying.
I'm saying it. No.
It wasn't a good fit. It wasn't a good fit. I wasn't the guy.
I'm just kidding. I'm a comedian. I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. Now I'm all paranoid. So that wasn't, that didn't work well.
Yeah. But you know, you keep sort of kind of chopping new ground, chopping through the forest and these new paths. I think this iHeart thing is huge. It's such a big company and they've really embraced this podcasting thing. And it sounds like you'll always have your feet in both worlds, but it sounds like podcasting is really kind of, with your branded content company now, like really kind of your focus?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely love this business. I love in the fact that with iHeart, I get to work in both and work with, you know, five radio stations and then create these new podcasts. It's pretty much the dream job for me. I really think that this podcast business is going to continue to change and grow. And hopefully we'll see different kinds of content start coming out through the podcasting. But I think the more easy it is for someone to listen, and I think that voice assistant things like Alexa are going to really be helpful as far as people being able to find podcasts and listen to them. Because it's still, for a lot of people, a little complicated to figure out how to go listen to one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to tell people, if you have an Android, you can't. That's one of the things I wish the industry could figure this out. Like, you know, if you have an Android phone, you can't get it on iTunes. You got to go to Audio Boom or something else. Do you think there's going to be a day when that just all becomes uniform and any phone can access any podcast anywhere that it's posted?
Well, they can now. Not to pump iHeart, but I mean, with iHeart, if you have the iHeart app, you can listen on any kind of phone. But I think that's always, I don't think there's going to be like a player for all podcasts on all phones. But there's just, you know, first of all, nobody in the business, we don't want that. You know, we want people to come on our player and use our what we're doing. I think Apple has really dropped the ball. The new version of their app is I don't know what they were thinking. It's kind of a mess right now. And And I'm somebody who's always, even when I worked, you know, with Stitcher, I still would use the Apple app from time to time. You know, I go back and forth and I use all three. I use Apple, iHeart, and Stitcher because I like to see which is easier. Mm-hmm. And they will figure it out, especially now that there's so much money being pumped into podcasting. I mean, it is ridiculous the amount of money that has increased in podcasting in the last year. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's here to stay. The thing that's great about this, is that you can hear it. I mean, you're a friend, I've known you a long time and I've known this, but I think the listeners can hear that, how passionate you are about it and, how well versed you are about it. And you've got this natural, mentor kind of point of view, which is nice. You want to impart this wisdom on people. And I know how energized you are about that, which is terrific. And, I'm glad that you're doing what you sound like you love to do right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love, you know, when I got the job at iHeart, I said, I have to keep teaching at the university. I need that. I need to be teaching. I like doing that. And especially this topic.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, you're the best. You've always been great to me, and it's been a long friendship, which will continue forever. And I will see you when I come out west, or you got to see me when you come to New York. You all should go on iHeartMedia and check out all the stuff that Maddie and his cohorts are doing there. And Maddie Media is on the web, and you can check that out. He's got a really cool consulting company. And he's a very good human being who worked with G. Gordon Liddy, which blows me away. it's like the most amazing.
And don't forget to listen to my show, Access Podcast. You can go find that anywhere. You can find podcasts. Access.
I did the show. Had a great time. You're always going to have a show of some kind, I would imagine, right? But
yes.
This is kind of the one that you really kind of wanted to have at this stage of your career.
Oh man, I love doing this show right now. It's so much fun to be able to talk to podcasters and you know have you on and you know Phoebe from Criminal and you know the Seth Lynn from This American Life, just people I respect.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, go check that out. It's Access Podcast, Maddie Stout, and if you're in any need for branded content, go check out his Maddie Media Consulting Company. You're the best, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, man.
All right, Maddie Stout, cool guy, good friend. Really, really interesting stuff that he's doing, cutting edge and teaching as well. Hope you enjoyed it, and hope you guys can make it out to see me January 18th to the 20th at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in the West Edmonton Mall. Go online for tickets, and it's cold. Wear a scarf, that's all. Come on, step up.